Hello and welcome to Prime Lenses. I'm Ian. Each week I speak to a photographer about three lenses that have meant something to them on their photographic journey. It's unashamedly gear chat, but hopefully focused more on the images made with that gear than performance metrics and graphs. My guest this week is Justin Mott, a photographer based in Hanoi in Vietnam, but as you'll tell from his accent, not from there originally. I had to get up at silly o'clock in the morning to talk to him, which is why I might sound a little bit quieter than I normally am, but that's what happens when you get up at 4 a.m. to talk to someone on the other side of the world. But Justin's great fun, and you can hear his enthusiasm for photography and image making pretty much out of the gate. He was ready to go, which was great. I really, really love his images. He's done some incredible work about conservation and saving animals from extinction with rhinos, and then photo series about the people who care for those animals. He's a really interesting photographer. He's done the work. So without further ado, here is my very early conversation with Justin Mott. Thank you so much for doing this. How's Hanoi today?
It is crappy out. I started my day. I put all my cycling gear on today. I was ready to go out for a ride, and I checked the weather, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it says dry. It didn't rain overnight. Not supposed to rain till the afternoon. And I looked outside, and like, I saw these messages on a cycling group that I'm part of, and I'm like, oh, everyone bailed, and I was going to go solo anyways, but I'm like, oh, it rained. And I'm when I'm training hard, I don't care if it rained, but I'm in like a weak mental state now where I need it all to be perfect to go out to go cycling. You know, like, you know, when you bounce in a lot of exercise, I'm like, oh, I'm not at a good, strong month. I'm just getting back into it as I train for this triathlon coming up. So I'm like, no, I'll train indoors today. So that was how my day started. As you can see, it's pretty crappy out.
Yeah, it does look a bit blown, like misty, sort of hazy.
That's actually like, what it looks like. It's not like overexposed. It's just
that. No, looks right.
Like. We have pretty bad pollution here too.
Yeah, yeah, but you're high up at least. You've got a good view, which is quite nice.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, it's all right.
On the river, and it's a nice view, and I get nice natural light in my house, so that keeps me happy.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, isn't it? As if you're interested in photography and you sort of like you chase light, like we moved last year, so we now live in the Highlands, and I'm in the new house. I'm finding where the light goes through the day, and where the little kind of like, you know, sometimes you make images of things just because they're there, and that kind of chasing little sort of shafts of light or things that follow, just sort of you're learning the space, I guess, and sort of learning it through using your own lens and stuff. And so it is fun, like when you're in a place like that, but the amount of light you get through from those windows and stuff, and when I've seen your pictures, it looks amazing, that place to live, you know, in terms of like the view of the world that you must get to see the city around.
Yeah, I mean, I have great light coming in. I know the light in this house well because I've just shot it so many times, and during COVID it's like let me see what I can do. Self-portrait series, shots of my wife, shots of my dogs. Like I worked my house and the light to death during COVID. And then where can I film my YouTube channel? And then we did a whole 7-month renovation. And then it was like, oh, let me photograph it now. And now that it's all different. So I've worked my house to death with natural light, but I still kind of love it. And I am lucky. I have a cool space here. It's an ugly building from the outside. It looks like what you see in the background there, but in the inside, we've got a nice special space that took a lot of work, but it's finally where we want it to be. Now we might be building a floor above us too, because that's available for sale. So we might be taking that on.
Right.
It's more of like, I'm afraid of who's going to go up above me. So I'm just going to, we might buy it for that purpose.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you have the means, then why not? I think make the space around yourself. Yeah.
Why not?
No one ever says, you know, I wish I had less space. So really, you know, generally, like, you know,
no one ever says I didn't wish I had some horrible person above me running a gym or a karaoke place or something. Oh, I want that. I mean, no one ever said they wanted that. So.
Yeah, once the karaoke people move in, that's it, it's all over.
And you know what? In Vietnam, that could easily happen. So we're going to make a defensive buy and buy it in the next coming months.
Yeah, exactly. Just occasionally, you just go up there and just sort of walk around it. Just look around over the city. That sounds pretty
cool. It's a nice space. It's actually a really nice space. So I think for photography, I can put a little backdrop in there and I can play around too with some natural light, or even rent it out to some people. So it's going to be like a transitional space where we can live up there, dogs can go up there, and then also people can rent it out, and it can be separated from our house a little bit too. So they can rent it out and use it for whatever, you know, people want to do a YouTube episode or do a photo shoot or create content. Now it's like funny, right? It used to be like either photo studio or video. Now it's just like, oh, just content. People just want to do content. So that has to be a genre that you appeal to in all your business. Even me now with our photography studio, we like now teach people how to create content. That's becoming a thing in education, like content creator education. It's interesting.
Yeah, it must be a real big change because you've been, how long have you been in Hanoi now or in Vietnam?
Yeah, I've been all in Hanoi the whole time and for 17 years about, yeah.
Yeah, because that was when I was, the great treat of doing this, I think, is doing some background research and finding out about people's careers and kind of how things have started. You can't have imagined when you started and doing that first photo series that it would end here. You know, that you would be here and you know.
No, not at all. And all the different types of stuff too. Like, I think that's something that I've struggled, like my career, I've always thought it was just going to be journalism and photojournalism. And I mean, and that was kind of it. And then I just realized when I came out here, like I like doing everything pays a lot better and it's more consistent. And yeah, my career just took a turn all over the place. And I never thought I'd have a YouTube channel. I never thought I'd be going to like Leica events. I never thought a big part of my income would be hotel and resort photography. You know, I do a lot of, and then I also do stuff that I can't even like share publicly online with a client that's been quite fruitful the last 2 years. And they're a great, awesome client, but I can't, NDA, can't share it here, can't share it online, can't put them in my bio as a client. So I have a lot of weird stuff. And I guess for me, it was always like, I've always embraced that, but I just did a post about this today. Like I always feel that the industries don't embrace it, or at least the industry of photojournalists, like they're always like, oh, if you do that, somehow you're lesser of one of them. You know, that's always something I've struggled with in my career. Like doing commercial work somehow lessens your impact of your editorial work or your personal project work. And I'm like, it's just stupid. I've always thought that, but now I'm just like kind of, screw it. I'm going to talk about both. And that's what I started doing my YouTube. I separate them both for business and marketing purposes. But overall, it's funny, right? Like even when you meet people and they say they do fashion and like, oh, but I also do journalism, you don't take them as serious. And I'm probably guilty of it sometimes too. But now I'm like, no, that's stupid. Because I know a ton of people that do both at a higher level than other people that just do one. So, and I feel like cocky to say, but I feel like I fall into that category. So I'm embracing it and I'm talking about it more, and they feed into the work as well. I think there's a consistent style to my commercial work that comes from my background in journalism and even doing weddings. Like that's not something I talk about. That's like taboo for photographers that are like hardcore documentary photographers to say they also do weddings. It's like stupid. Why? You have to be a very proficient photographer to do a wedding, probably better than any other type of photography. You have to know it all. You know, you have to be able to do details, portraits, reportage, group portraits, detail shots, everything on the fly too. So yeah, it's always something I've struggled with talking about my career, but it's something I'm open with now as I get older to talk about a little bit more. Cause I think it's silly to discourage that for younger photographers because like they need to promote themselves. It's a saturated and tough market and you need to shoot a bit of everything if you really want to make a living out of it. So anyway, that's my little rant.
No, it's good. It's good. It's exactly why I want to have these conversations with people is because you kind of, I think a lot of media around photography doesn't dig in these ways. And you know, it's the conceit of the series, the three lenses and everything is really just a thinly veiled excuse to sort of get into what matters to people, I suppose, and what's important about the work that they make and why they enjoy doing it. And I completely agree. Like the minute you put artificial boundaries around things, you know, you start to make it harder for people to get engaged because they think, oh, actually photography is just street photography, and if I'm not doing street photography then I'm not a real photographer, or I'm not this or not. And it's very broad church, right? Like you should let people create the things they want to create, and if they can get the work and get the experience doing it, we'll do it. Isn't that better than, oh no, sorry, I can't do that job because on some odd psychological level I must only be, you know, you can't go and photograph endangered species every day of the week. That would be a very narrow
field
of work. You'd work for 5 days a year or something.
And also, as I start to pour more of my effort into education, I realize how silly it is and how how negative it is to put these things out there for people that are learning, like, or just misconceptions, because we get caught up in the ego part and the, well, I want to be known as this. I think, and I saw this when I entered the YouTube space, is like all these photographers out there that there's some that are professional photographers full on, meaning they make their money from taking pictures. We can define all different ways, but there's a lot that don't. And there's some that are there, and a lot of them are fantastic teachers, no doubt about that. But there's also another batch of them that like to dabble over into the world of talking about like, oh, I make this amount of money off, or I do this, and they don't. They make their money from YouTube, and that's fine, and that's great, and they're really good at it. But the ones that don't, I think that's dangerous, because then you're teaching people like that quality of work that they're showing, which sometimes is not, and often, I'm not going to BS, isn't that great, or let's say it's not worthy of making a living off of, you know? And then you're teaching other people that, and then they buy into that. And that's dangerous to me. And that's what I like to talk about. Like I make $20,000 a month off of travel photography, or street photography is a great example of that. It's a wonderful genre, and there's people that do well online, but I can't tell you I know anybody who makes a living just off of street photography. I mean, I'm sure there are online, and it's such a small fraction of people that do it. And then there's people that do it that's such a small fraction of their income. Like if you sell prints, or you're able to monetize it, great. But there's way less people that do that than that make money off of doing portraits, stuff that's not considered as sexy, you know, weddings, commercial photography, advertising. But I don't think anyone likes to say that online. They don't like to talk about that's where they really make their money from, or that's because it somehow takes away from that. And it shouldn't. The ones that do street photography really well, that's its own thing. But I'm, you know, as an educator now, I'm afraid of what that can teach a younger generation as far as the reality of the industry. So I try to correct those things, but it's a tough sea to navigate, because every time you do, you sound bitter, you sound like a jerk, and I'm not. Like I'm pretty damn happy. I'm a pretty optimistic person, but I like to like point these things out, and I don't like to call out individuals because it's just not my style, but there's a lot of people out there, or even, you know, let's just say, for example, even to call out an individual, but let's just say like the thing that sort of bugged me in the beginning before I did YouTube was that Steve McCurry scandal that people seem to brush over. Like he positioned himself as a journalist. This is kind of different waters. We don't have to go down this too far, but like to call himself a documentary photographer to be published in journalism websites like National Geographic, but then to like all of a sudden get caught of doing things that are like totally wrong from a journalistic standpoint, ethical standpoint, and then just scrub that from your bio, and then we all just accepted it. I'm like, well, that's not cool either. Not to take away from the beauty of his work, but it's commercial. It's beautiful in the context of commercial photography. It's not, you could call it travel, but I mean, you're talking about setting scenes, asking friends to put outfits on, carrying luggage, and then ethically removing things from photographs. Yeah. It's like, that's like 101. Anyway, that's a whole other thing, and I don't want to like trash somebody, but I find it interesting that people don't, more people weren't sort of kind of upset about that, or had more of a dialogue about it. We just kind of forgot about it and moved on, but not me.
No, never forget. It was funny, you were posting sort of on something that's adjacent to this, but isn't the same thing the other day, and that was when I was prompted. I was like, I've got to get Justin on. Like, it was when you were talking about people asking the wrong questions, the wrong sorts of questions about photography.
Yeah,
because I think that's really useful. It's very tricky to navigate. Like I enjoy using Instagram. I discover photographers that way. I see interesting work. I get in trouble. But you're right. It nudges us down a route of like a different type of, the wrong type of conversation, or you sort of learn, you can learn the bad habits or the wrong, somehow the wrong way of doing things. And I think also crucially, it keeps making those of us who don't do it for their job and aren't burdened by it being, you know, teach it. I've been to events where I feel like I've got to get coverage, and like I'm just at the MotoGP. I can just enjoy this. I could just walk it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny thing.
Yeah, it is, and I also think that feeds into what I'm talking about. It's the questions that are important to ask. Like if we don't talk about those things when we have conversations with each other, amateurs, pros, or people that sort of hybrid in between, that do a little bit of both, then no one ever knows. Because I get people all the time that say to me like, oh, like you just did that, you know, New York Times story. I'd love to do that, like dabble in that, as if it's just like you could just easily do it. It's not that easy. And I just did kind of an episode about covering tragedy and that kind of stuff. And that I'm not saying anyone can't do it. They can, but there is a set of skills that goes into it that's different than street photography, and not just skills, but ethics and understanding, like being fair to a story. You don't have to be fair when you go and take street photography. People don't. People can mislead or even fair. So what are we saying with someone that's not really kind of, that doesn't really get much trouble for saying, doing things that are ethically wrong? What are you teaching people about the industry and about that genre of photography? So that's the part. The problem is it's always misconstrued as like you're jealous of that person. You're not. I'm not. Like, he'll be way more successful than I ever will be in photography. I'm okay with that, you know, as far as recognition and that kind of stuff. But when it comes to certain things in journalism, like, well, that's right and this is wrong and that's unethical and this isn't. Mm. And I don't know, those conversations I think are just important to have. And then the bigger reason I did that post was more just about, you know, like I said, seeing things through the eyes of an educator a little bit more now. And because I do online classes and I teach workshops and things, it's like, it's good to have people have a conversation. Like, ask me not what lens I use, but why I use that lens, you know, why I like that one. And I'm guilty, man, too. Like, I like talking about gear. I do gear reviews. Like, I did a post about not talking about gear, and then a day later released an episode about 100mm macro lens, and I'm waiting for people to give me crap about it. However, my point of that was like, I still like to talk about like how I can use a tool creatively, a macro lens for me for portraits. That was what the core of my episode was about, not particularly how awesome that lens is or that lens may be better, but the fact that I could get closer with a macro lens and how I use that to get different types of portraits. And just talking about vintage lenses, like, I like that, but I'm so tired of, like, I go to these events and it's like a 90-10 split. 90% will talk about that and 10%. And I think my YouTube channel, to be fair to me, is more about that. It's more about teaching. And I still like to talk about gear sometimes, but I just wish it was more equal. I wish it was completely flipped, but if we could get it to equal, I'd be happy. Like, talking about, how do I start a project? How do I get access like that? And sort of getting rid of sort of misconceptions too. I think a lot of amateurs think they can't do a project about whatever I'm doing, rhinos or sloths. Like, you can. It's not like I have like an official badge that says like, nope, let me in. I'm officially a journalist. You just got to talk to people and get access to the story. And sometimes they can do them even better than we can, because they're not like beholden to the industry and all those rules and worried about winning competitions and maybe can even a lot more time to a project. Like, I noticed a whole interesting trend of like retirees interested in my channel and seeing them, like, you guys, like, I talk to them about starting projects and they love it. And I think it's like, it never clicked, like, oh, well, I can't because I'm not. I'm like, well, why? You're just documenting a friend who's a musician or an athlete or a story about your town. There's no rules. You know, there's no special club. You can do it. So I like to help people do that kind of stuff and encourage people to talk more about the process. And I miss it, because in school, we used to really talk about that kind of stuff, the meaning of our photography, storytelling, sequencing images, having a dialogue. And I've just noticed, like, YouTube is not so interested in that. And I get, for the masses, no, but there's a lot of people out there that want to improve. And you're just not going to improve if 90% of your talk is why this 100mm macro is better than the other one, or this 35, or should I upgrade to this camera? You know, balance it out a little bit more. Learn from, especially when you talk to photographers doing it that you admire, ask them the right questions. That was kind of my point.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's funny what you were saying about telling stories and running the story down. My dad, before he passed away, he loved photography, and he would just, because he was retired, would just drive around, and he would come back and he would get articles published in like sort of local magazines like Cheshire Life and Yorkshire Life and stuff, because he would go somewhere and he'd be talking to someone who like bred a certain type of sheep, and then he would go and photograph it and just write it up as a story, and he would just contact this magazine and no permission needed. Like, he was in his 80s and he would just contact a magazine. So
cool. And he has all different perspective on things, and probably fearless, because he doesn't care what people think about his work or him at that age.
Exactly.
You know?
And you also get a different story out of people when you're a kind of doddery old gent with an EOS 350 just going higher. A lot of his photos, when I look back at them, because I have a lot of them, it's a bunch of people who just look a bit confused as to why they've suddenly been pulled into a photo shoot at no notice. And they just stood.
That's really cool that you have that.
Yeah, but it's good stories, and it's interesting, it's real, it's human life. But that's a nuanced and not very kind of hot and kind of sexy cool thing to be like, this person just went and documented these people who are doing this interesting thing actually over here. and it's you read it for 5 minutes and then move on, but everyone's enriched by the experience. The people felt good about what they were doing. You read something you would never have read any other way, and just everyone goes, oh, that's nice. And I think the problem is that part of the media landscape now and the way that we produce, as you were saying right at the top, content, is it has to be so punchy and so high contrast and so kind of edited together to within an inch of its life, but for God's sake, not more than 90 seconds long. And just, there's all this kind of, you know, it has to have so much impact, whereas it's hard to kind of tell the story of some people who are just doing some consistent, interesting work, you know?
Well, it's a great point. I think the media landscape is interesting. It's sort of like YouTube. It's like if I just want to get it fast now, I can do build a following of people, just numbers. If I want pure numbers on Instagram, I know it's a post. If I want pure numbers on YouTube, just reviews. This camera sucks. I changed all my camera gear, threw it away, and then took it out of the garbage and then used it again. Like, but that's everyone does that. And they can have growth, but it's empty growth and there's emptiness. Mm-hmm. Like my following is a lot smaller, but I've learned through YouTube, it's like, wow, I'm meeting like-minded people. I'm meeting people that really care about photography, that want to take my workshops, that want to take classes, that want to learn depth, and they are asking a lot of the right questions. So I'm kind of like finding my people in that way. And it's kind of the same with photography. You can take the quick winners and the cheap way out, or you can go long-term and lean into it and hopefully less people will see it, but more people have an impact. That's the way I kind of look at my work and photography and on my YouTube. Like when I started my YouTube channel, I did a couple episodes where I just showed my work. So I'm like, hey, nobody does this. And I have a decent, like there's other photographers with much more prestigious bodies of work, but like I have a decent body of work from almost 2 decades in this region for pretty big magazines and newspapers, the biggest, I guess you could say. And I thought, oh, everyone's going to love this. And guess what? They didn't. And no one watched it. And then I said, okay, I'm trusting people more. I'm learning from them and I'm getting the right people. And then I've started to do it recently. It's easily my most successful. I mean, again, that's relative to me. It's not like they're wildly successful, but like those videos do really well. They get the most engagement and they get the right kind of engagement. They get people asking me the right questions. So it's like funny. It's same content. I'm probably a little more polished now in my lighting and all that stuff, but it's really the same thing essentially. And now it's working. It's just because I didn't find the right audience. And I kind of feel that way about my photography too. I used to think it always had to be in these big publications to make an impact, right? It had to go into the New York Times or Washington Post. And to be honest, what has more of a tangible impact is when it can be directed online. That's what you can use social media for. So I can have my Rhino stories. We're probably not going to raise much money if it goes in the Washington Post. People are aware of it. Other publications on the story, cool. But if I work with an NGO and I'm an ambassador for helping rhinos and they use my images to raise money, that's a concrete, that's something tangible. That's like, okay, there's money that's helped. And they also use the images from the conservation, the scientific standpoint to use to promote what they're doing. So that's a win for me. And that's not how I used to think before. I always thought success looked like that. It looked like being published in a newspaper and you're going to change the world. And it's like, no, not that I'm changing the world now, but at least I'm having some tangible impact with my images. And that's what I always wanted to do from the start of my photography. And it's just a different way of doing it. And there's so many other ways. And there's probably ways I haven't thought about, you know, even telling stories like I am now on YouTube and reliving my images and talking about the story. It's having an impact and helping other people tell their stories. So that's it. I think as long as you're open-minded to different ways, then you don't have to be worried about, like, I don't like the term gatekeeper. A lot of people say that, but I always feel like that you have to kind of earn it. Like, I don't think that, anyway, that's a whole discussion, but I think that there's less obstacles now. You know, you can find your own way to self-publish and get it out there. It's not easy. It takes a lot of time like anything good does, but you can do it now. And that's the nice thing. You can start your own podcast. You can start your own YouTube channel. And that's, it just takes a lot of time, but you can do it, you know? And I think that's a cool thing.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can have a dream literally on Christmas Eve 2023 where Jason Momoa is showing you lenses and wake up and that becomes a podcast where you're talking to Justin Mott. Right, that's a true story. That's where this came from. Yeah, I dreamt that Jason Momoa was showing me his collection of Leica lenses and then woke up and thought, that should be a podcast. And so I wrote a blog post on Christmas Day, I think it was, or a couple of days later, where I said, you know, I'll do this series and we'll talk about three lenses. And that's where the title comes from, prime lenses, because it's a prime number. And then and then I said, and the series will end when I interview Jason Momoa. And there we go. And so, and I set a really nice long timeline. I gave myself until March to launch, and it's just been a nice background thing. And I now I'm getting up at like, it's really funny, I'm probably overbooked. Like I've got you now, because it's 20 past four in the UK. So I've got up a bit. So your 5 a.m. start, I've got up an hour earlier than your normal start.
Wow.
But I'll get you today, and then I've got another guy tonight, and I'm just sort of, I'm banking them so that I've got plenty in the tank.
Sure.
And then that way real life can happen.
No, sure, the photographers that want to talk about themselves, myself included.
Well, it's really fun. It's a real gift.
I think it comes from, like, we all work alone, and except in my commercial work, we work alone. So when someone wants to talk to us about our work, it's always like, it's refreshing. It's like, oh, cool. Yeah, I would love to. Really, you want to talk about it? Because you're normally doing, you're not talking. Yeah. And you come back from your shoots, and it's like, it's not like the office is clapping, and oftentimes I've risked my life on assignments, and I just get a letter from an email from the editor, like, got him. I'm like,
yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, no, not like thanks or great job or you almost got arrested or thrown out of that country or detained. It's like, got him, cool.
Yeah.
Like, oh. And it's not like they didn't like them. They read them on the front page. I'm like, you know, a nice little, like, great job, Justin. Thanks for doing it for that pay. But no, that's not.
This is what we need to do next, is a support network for photographers. So
we'll take any time someone wants to hear us talk or appreciate us.
Well, so we can use that, I think, as a nice segue onto kind of the conceit of the series, which is to talk about like three lenses that you've chosen. Because I think it's interesting, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about your work and the system, you know, almost everyone I'm talking to at the moment, and I must move in certain circles, is picking Leica Glass and the M system. And especially for your kinds of work, I'm assuming that things like the size, the portability, the robustness of those units, like what got a Leica in your hands for the first time and made you think, yes, this is the right tool for the job? Is it the way you use it? What aspects of it kind of appealed, I guess?
Yeah, well, early on in my career, I used the Leica film camera just a little bit. I took it to Venezuela. I was doing some. I just love the feel. I had M6 and I had I forget what 35. I'm not like back then. I can't remember. It wasn't one of the really good 35s. It was more affordable. So there's no way I could buy a $4,000 lens back then. And I just remember enjoying that experience. I remember enjoying the rangefinder experience. And then fast forward to like 20 years later, I'm using Hasselblad X1D for my commercial work, Sony kit, Canon kit, Nikon. I've used everything. I did a TV show with Canon about Canon cameras. I've literally used like every camera out there. And then I just, all of a sudden, like a whirlwind of assignments and jobs go by and all this different kind of stuff. And I just was like, I turned 40 and I'm like, damn, like, how did that happen? I'm 45 now, so that was 5 years ago. And I'm like, all right, where's the personal project work that I started with? Where's that Justin? Where did he go? I'd like to find him. And he had all this great, well, not great hair, but he had hair and he just, and he was fit. And I'm like, where did he go? But more importantly, it was like, where did the photography soul of myself go? And it was like back to those stories. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna reset here. I'm gonna go back to doing stories. And I've made enough money in the commercial work where I can. So what do I care about? I care about animals and I like animal stories, but I don't like wildlife photography. I like people and stories. And I'm inspired by people who help animals. And that's what I did early in my career. I followed what I was curious about and I documented it and I put aside time. And now it's like, fast forward all these years of all my New York Times stuff, it was always someone else's story, someone else's timeline. And I kind of had to do it part my way and part their way. And I thought, okay, this is a chance for me to like, what do I have? Who am I as a photographer now? I haven't even got to like unleash that on the world or on a story. So I started to look again at like, I think I just randomly caught an article about the M10D. I'm like, I didn't even know this existed, a digital camera without a screen. And I was like, oh, that's ridiculous. And then I'm like, wait, it's kind of not. It's kind of how I started, because I used to use, I used the M6, but also in college, in university, I used it like a Rebel. And it was a film camera, but I just go and get it developed. I didn't develop it myself. So I'm not like one of those cool film guys. I can say I used to develop film. I'd leave that part out in those conversations with hipsters. But I did shoot film. Someone else developed it. I was like, that's actually where I started. So that's my roots, a weird hybrid system of not being able to see. But it was more about slowing down. And I'm like, all right, I know my habits because I'm an antsy person. I shoot fast. I work fast. And sometimes it's really good and sometimes it's not. But when I'm doing a story, I'm like, I just want to slow down. And so at the same time, looking for a new story, I found the story about the Northern White Rhino. I thought, what a great time to reset my gear and say, let's try this. Let's try a small system. I went to Leica Singapore. I had no relationship with them. I'm just like, hey, I'm a photographer. I do this, blah, blah, blah. I got in touch with someone there. And I'm like, can I borrow that camera? I'm thinking about buying it. And they did. I mean, I'm lucky to have that. Not everyone gets that chance. They let me borrow it for a day in Singapore. And I was just like, wow, this is such a cool experience. This is what it was like when I was younger. I didn't feel the weight of the camera on me. I didn't even need a bag. I could just have it on my shoulder. And my early days of when I went to San Francisco State, I lived in San Francisco a long time, 7 years, I guess. And I'd wander the streets with a camera and no bag. And I'd have a coffee in the afternoon. I'd shoot again. And then once the light got dark, I'd have a beer and I'd sort of go out and shoot street at nighttime. And I just explored the city. It was like my own time, personally and creatively. And this reminded me of that. So a little bit of nostalgia got me into the M10D. Fell in love with that camera after a day. I'm like, all right, I got to figure out a way to buy this. Bought it, which seemed ridiculous because it was like $8,000, I think. Mm. And then I was like, well, I need a lens. So I bought the 35. That's always been my go-to focal length. It's just kind of how I like to shoot, with a one lens system for portraits and for sort of reportage. And it just blended well. I took it to Africa for the Northern White Rhino series. So it was like new camera, new system, new Justin, new way of thinking, new subject matter. Wow. And it all came together. And it's funny, like that, funny enough, that story and that experience produced me getting an image that was used in a like ad campaign around the world that they still use to this day. And so it was like kind of a cool moment for me. The ad campaign thing happened years later, but that story was like, it was my best work personally. I felt I did, maybe not even the images that they chose. Some of the other ones I like better, but I was just like, this is who I am. This is, or at least this is who I've become. And I got a chance to showcase that. And I was quite proud of it and am still proud of it. And that sort of reset me in that commercial, in that headspace, and to go out and go shoot this kind of work again, and, you know, push me. And then I was really in a hot streak, and then COVID happened and slowed down a bit, but I've still got the project in my mind. They live as their own chapters, but they're also feeding into a bigger project, which I want to make into a book. And yeah, it just kind of set me up. And then I started, now I'm like dabbling into like Leica, into my, I've already used it in my assignment work, so not just personal assignment. And now I'm thinking going full on into my commercial photography as well with the SL3 and doing work with that. So yeah, that was like, sorry, it's a long story, but that was my reset back into Leica, but also reset in my photography and what I fell in love with. And I still absolutely love that camera. I can't talk about it enough. However, the one thing that was funny about this world is like when I wrote an article about it because I used to like to write about photography. No one watched my, read my, because people just don't read anymore. But I wrote a long blog post about it. And then Petapixel, I always say it wrong. Petapixel, yeah, they picked it up. And my goodness, I was like, I didn't realize how many people, I knew some people love Leica, but I didn't realize how many people hate it. And that article, the comment, where people just tearing me apart. And it's a damn camera. It's not like I was saying, if you don't buy this camera, you're crappy photographer. I was just saying I love it and why, and here's why I can justify it. But that was my intro. Luckily for me, that didn't scare me off for talking about Leica. Now my whole channel is built on that. But wow, the beginning was rough. You know, the first few people that watch my channel are like, oh, I might not like this. I'm not a very positive person, and I usually just like delete negativity when I can. Yes. So it was tough in the beginning.
Yeah, no, it's a funny thing. But again, it goes back to what you were saying earlier, like people putting rules on things, or you're wrong. I've friends of family and stuff, like my stepdad shoots with Sony gear, really loves photography, has an A7C, loves it. Great, small, compact, like portable as he gets older for carrying around. And he's got friends who are very look down their nose at the fact that I shoot with a Leica. They're like, well, it's just this and it's just that. And so they've never used one. They don't, you know, held one. They don't. And it's like, well, that's fine. Use the thing you like, right? Like if you want that Canon, that is brilliant. Yeah. If you like using it, I am, you know, besotted with this thing in a way that's definitely unhealthy. But but you know, like your similar origin story, right? Like the opportunity presented itself. I got a bonus at work. I was like, you can buy an M10. It's like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do the thing. And the first episode was an interview with a friend of mine, Danny, who's shot M's for years. And he sort of like was messaging me on Instagram. And he's like, okay, are you sure? Because you're going to do this. This is like, they're weird, but this is a whole different. And it was this odd support network that comes around you. Where it was like a bat signal went up and they were like, we've got another one. Hang on. Right. Bring him in properly. You know, just check he's okay. This is going to feel weird. There's no autofocus. Like, you know, I'd spent years telling people the greatest camera ever made was the Ricoh GR3. And I still love that camera. I think it's incredible. But to go from that to a rangefinder style camera with manual focus, with, you know, everything. But now I run, you know, over getting on for 2 years later and I run around everywhere with my 35. I mean, I commit the sin of my 35, my favorite 35 isn't even a Leica lens. It's a Zeiss. You know, like, I love that lens. The 35-28 is my first camera was a Canon MC film point and shoot, which was a 35 f/2.8. And then when I shot Sony, my favorite was their Zeiss 35 f/2.8. So I think in my head, there's something unusual that like that's what a picture looks like. Sort of, it's ingrained in my brain now.
Love the versatility, and the other thing I didn't really touch on is just the fact that it's so much easier for it to like sit on your neck. As I got older and all the more responsibility for all the jobs, the bag gets bigger and you wear your camera less and you carry it more. And then I was like, oh, but in the beginning of my career, I traveled with my camera everywhere, around my neck always. So then things like when I'm documenting the Rangers, like I did the story about the caretakers of the rhinos, but I did a separate story about the Rangers. And we're on these, like, you know, on the back of this truck and rattling around, like back in the that like in between period, I probably would have just threw everything in my bag and not just had the camera on my neck and just like taken a pause. But this time I was like, oh, it's just on my neck, or it's in my lap. It's always right there. So when something comes up, I'm just shooting. Right. And that's what, you know, jump photojournalism is. You're ready to go.
Yes.
And I was like losing a step in that way by having my gear, because it like emotionally and physically weighed you down and just having those big roller bags. And I was like, oh, I could even not have a bag, you know, and I could just go out for the day with this camera. It just, and I'm not like a pusher. I don't think it works for everyone. I think if you don't have the patience, or if you don't have it in you to want to have the patience or shoot that way or to be disciplined, that's totally fine too. But I do, and it helps me. It helps bring that out of me. You know, it helps remind me or forces me into what I think are good habits for me. But I don't think they're for everyone. People ask me about the M10D. Should I get one? I'm like, I have no effing idea if you should. I don't know you well enough. You know, if I don't know you really well and you're not willing to do it, put the time in, don't do it. You'll regret it. You know, but if you are, if you're okay with slowing down a lot and you think it forces you into the good habits, then go for it. You know, that's my thoughts on it. But I'm not when I review gear, I review gear that I love and I use, or that I'm really interested in using. And I just talk about it selfishly about my use case. I brush on other things, but there's just too many variables for other photographers to weigh in. I'm happy to have the discussion with people, but I don't know. I can't make people want me to make the decision for them. I'm like, I can't.
Can you imagine over Instagram DMs making the decision for someone to spend 10 grand on a camera? That's insane.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, that's and I'm not getting my cut because they don't have like an affiliate program. My goodness, if I did, then
use promo code Justin at checkout.
Imagine if they gave me the 5% that I get, or 10% from Wovencraft.
There you go. Nice. That would be good. I mean, that's the dream. But so one thing I wanted to ask about as well is your list has a 35 and a 50, both the Sumaluxes, right?
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because I carry a 35 and a 50 in my bag as well. And I do that because they're different. The kind of the character of both those lenses is very different. It's not just the focal length. It's the fact that like for me, the 50 is a Summicron and the 35 is the Zeiss 2.8. And I sort of view them as like my 35 is my black and white lens. Like when I've had images selected for like the Leica gallery, the LFI gallery online, they're always black and white. They're always my Zeiss shots of children. I don't know. It's just a funny thing that sort of that's happened. But the 50, I feel like, is my color lens. The Summicron is my color lens, and it goes down to F2. So you can do a bit of separation. You can do a portrait with it, but you can also, you know, get a wider shot. But 35-50 sometimes is viewed as they're a bit too close. So I'm curious, like, what's your reason for carrying a 35 and a 50? Because they are close. It's true.
They are close. And a lot of people ask me that. A lot of people are like, why wouldn't you have a 28 and a 50? Or you can go a 35 and a 75. And I've had these discussions a lot with people online, hence the post about talking less, but I still like to talk about it. So I'm happy to. But it was just like, okay, when I make that decision, it was, I was using the 35 so much that maybe I was getting a little stale with my 35 shots that I have. Like, you have these, like I call them your Rolodex of shots, and then you expand on that by practice and shooting and projects. But that also limits you creatively to some extent, where it's like, oh, I used to use a 50 more. So I don't necessarily use them together. I use them separately. So if I'm, let's say if I was doing the Northern White Rhino story, I might just leave one at home one day if I was there for like 2 weeks, just to because I can't help it. I'll be like, ooh, reach into the bag. Yeah. And I know that I'll start thinking that way. Again, this is only what works for my weird mind, and we all have weird minds, but this is how my brain thinks. So it's like, so I'll go out and shoot street one day with a 50, another day with a 35, because I just want to see things a little bit differently, or shoot the same thing. And I'll see it differently and I'll work differently. And I like that. And I'll learn new things about myself. So it's not so much to use together, it's to use separately. So I shot a coffee story for the New York Times about coffee culture. I'm very proud that I didn't use my accent right there, because I'm from Rhode Island. Normally I would say coffee culture, but I didn't use it, I don't think. So I did, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to not use the 35. I still need to bring it professionally, just because if there's a wider shot, have it. But I used just a 50, and I shot differently, and I thought differently, and I saw things differently, and I trust myself enough that I can get it at the high level. And get images at the high level. And I did. And I was, that made it fun for me. So I think it's a little selfish sometimes. Like, let me mix it up a bit. I just shoot like a lot. I think it's not a lot of people can say that. Like, I'm always doing something shooting. Yeah. So it's easy to get burnt out on lenses. And then when I shoot commercially, an 85 is so important to me, because an 85 wide open lens, I consider that lens, like, it bails me out of a lot of crap, you know, like, oh, client needs X, Y, and Z. I'm like, all right, that lobby's not interesting. I got to put the, let me throw the 85 on it. Still want a nice picture and everything else to work well, but it bails me out of stuff. But yeah, I used to think when I shot weddings and I shot news sort of type things, just to have every focal length in my primes covered. But now I don't think so much like that. I'm like, I can still get a wide with a 35 by moving back, and I can use a 50 differently when I want to, or a 50 might even force me to do like portraits one day where I wouldn't want to do portraits on the street, you know, even though I do portraits with 35 too, but different types of portraits. Or 35 makes me want to frame through things a little bit more, and sometimes I can overdo that, so I want to take a step back and not do that. And so I use it more of a way separately, not together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's certainly nice having a light bag with not too much stuff in, which I know, like, there's a premium associated with that, but like the sort of the fortune that I have of like having this one small bag and this one small camera, which looks fairly unobtrusive and doesn't make too much noise and doesn't look too flashy and looks really old, and get swabbed at airports. Does your M10 get swabbed at airports? My M10,
man, we're lucky,
every
man.
Time.
All right. Really?
Yeah. I think it's because I'm on the 11 now, but the 10 was, I think, just this massive lump of brass, and they just never, they don't get that at airports.
Right,
and so like they knew it was a camera, but it would always get swabbed, and you'd end up having a conversation with somebody. Go, is it old? And you go, no, it's not that old. And it's, but the 11, I think, because it's made, I went for the aluminium for the weight.
Right, yeah.
I wanted it slightly. The thing that made me switch, and I'm not sure I'm in love with the 11 in the way that I was with the 10, but it's so versatile. It's so good. It's better in every way, in terms of like startup time, speed, the resolution. The resolution's a huge cheat, because you can photograph something. I got a lovely picture. I was out with the family at the weekend, and I got there was a very, very tame robin on a branch. And so the photo is like 60 megapixels. It's out here. And then I can crop in and have a usable photograph of a bird on a branch, which just, you know, I'm not here to tell you to buy an M11, because, you know, if you have an M10, you really don't need one. But I could, so I did. And it's wonderful in loads of ways. Sure. It's a really very, very good camera. And the weight saving for me, that 20% less weight in the black one, is significant when you're out all day and carrying it around and just, like, you know, have it on you. It's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I sometimes, I'm different. Some jobs I have to just carry a bunch of lenses just to have them. Mm-hmm. Some days I keep it interesting. Like I said, I shoot so many different things that I'm always like, oh, let's just use this lens. Today, let's try a combo of these lenses. Mm-hmm. I don't often shoot. People have asked me recently, do I shoot with two bodies at the same time? No, I carry two bodies because I have to. I mean, I can't really mess up if something goes wrong. So it's just like, so I'm very situational in my gear. So it's like, oh, I'll take maybe the SL2S will be my lead camera on an editorial shoot where it's tricky focus, or like I do a lot of animal stuff with fences. So that's hard with a rangefinder. It's like right up against a cage or a fence. So I have to use it there. And then my M10D is like, okay, just back up. Or sometimes like I have plenty of time with this subject. I'm just following them around. They do the same thing for 3 days. M10D, I can slow down. I can make a small mistake, which I don't typically. I'm pretty good at manual focus and exposure and all that. So it's fine for me. But I have so many different kits that I use for so many different things. And it's always, you know, moving. I even have like something I never thought I would use again, but I bought a 24-90 on the Leica SL2S because that covers me on a commercial shoot if something goes wrong with one of my primes, right? It's like, oh, that, I mean, it's an expensive insurance policy, but it is, but it also is nice. I'm always looking for like versatility. So that also is also a nice lens if I'm going to start to use my SL2S for video. So I've rigged it out with my a cage, and that covers me for stuff where I don't want to be changing lenses all the time on a cage system. So it's just like autofocus and a huge range. And that 90 is a nice little bonus there compared to the typical 24-70. So don't tell anyone that I use a zoom lens, because I always talk about
not. Got to keep that super secret, right? You're not a proper photographer unless you have a bag jangling full of primes.
Like, and there's so many great developers that use them well too. So it's a BS thing to say.
Oh, completely. It's did you get the image? Was everyone happy? Yeah. You know, like
and ask them how they got it, not what lens they used. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was going to touch on, actually. So is there a quality of those Summilux lenses to like the rendering of them, or the way that they, like, is there something about those lenses that you were like, yeah, I'm a goner? Or is it the practical versatility of it goes all the way down to 1.4 and all the way up, and, you know, at the higher end it's basically as sharp as anything else, so it's fine, I know I'll get the coverage, but also I've got that versatility if I can, because there's a bit of magic, isn't there, to a, like a really wide open wide photo sometimes, because you don't see that.
Yes, I it's a great question, because I think there's a lot of different reasons. I think early on in my career it was like, oh, I just have a great low light lens because you're a photojournalist. You're not using flash much. I mean, you could, but I just don't. And then even doing weddings, so it's like low light situations. And I want to use natural light in all my photography. So having a low light lens, fantastic. Plus back then cameras, like the ISO wasn't like it is now. You couldn't push to 8,000 and not worry about grain. 8,000 would be ruined, right? So you needed it back then. So I got caught up in having the best lens of whatever. When I shot with Canon, I had the L series. When I shot with Nikon, I can't remember what their top lens, but I always had the best 35. Was everything else I might cheap out on, but I never did on my 35. And when I went to Leica, I was like, all right, same thing. I like having the low light capabilities, but then it's also, to be completely honest, it's a lot of times for when you do assignment work and paid work, you've got to make something out of nothing. And and that's what photography is for a lot of people. It's like, oh, get a shot of this portrait, and this is the person has to do it here, and this is gonna like I'm always trying to talk my way into better light, better situations, better backgrounds. But the reality is sometimes it's like they've only got a little bit of time, or this situation is ugly. You've got to make this food look good, whatever it is. I tell you what, 1.4 makes it look pretty good. It fails me out of stuff, and then for professionally, but then personal work. I like the versatility of the low light. I like the look at 1.4, but you can easily overdo it too. One of my New York Times editors, like, I was really just relying on 1.4 for everything. And he was like, hey, dude. And he's the only one that actually would talk to me about this stuff. Usually you just get emails, never a phone call. But he messaged me. He's like, hey, 30. He's like, 1.4 is ruining a lot of your shots. I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, 1.4 is amazing. It's like, that's what makes me unique. He's like, no, it's not. What makes you unique is that you know how to use a 35 and you move well and tell a story. 1.4 just popping out when you, because I shoot through a lot of things. He's like, you've got all these blobby foregrounds. And I'm like, oh, I was defensive for like a minute, but this is like the New York Times foreign desk editor. And I was like, shit, yeah, he's right. I started to look at my work. I'm like, oh, I've got blobadocious everywhere. Like, you don't know what it is, and it's distracting. And if you're someone that, so I started to say, like, all right, let's get rid of this gimmicky thing from your playbook. Let's be more intentional with your aperture. But I just like having the option when I want to shoot, when I want a subject to pop. Like, I did a lot of these street portraits or assignments or Bloomberg travel stories and Bloomberg, sorry, financial stories, economy stories, like finding people on the street, maybe doing a quick portrait of them and in front of like a textured wall, and they could just 1:4, everything looked pretty good at 35 and take the shot. So it was at first just to be able to shoot low light, and then it was gimmicky, and then it was like, oh, I need to use it for everything. But be careful with overdoing the 1:4 thing. And that really did become a thing, because I noticed a lot of other people doing it too. And then once you see it in your own work, you can't unsee another people's work. You're like, oh, you've blobbed it up.
Like, yes.
You didn't get the editor. And it was nice, like, because it's a weird thing. I would say most jobs, you actually get feedback on your performance and it can improve. In photography, you don't. Like, no one ever really does. You either get hired or you don't, or the client doesn't come back to you. Maybe that's your feedback. But you never get someone that's like equal to you. It's like always someone in like, not equal to, I mean, equal to you in your knowledge of photography, right? It's like someone from a marketing team doesn't know a ton about photography. You're not going to get like great advice from them, like how to improve. But an editor, they don't do this much, but an editor that is willing to do that is very helpful. You know, so it's like your education stops in your photography career after school or whatever, you know, or I guess it doesn't have to on YouTube, but you're still not getting like feedback. You're just looking at other people's work. So that was important to me. And it's something that I think I wish I had more in my career, because I feel like I could have grown more. I always wanted feedback, but it was just like, oh, you're doing great. I'm like, yeah, but you probably have ideas on how I could be better. And that editor did that for me. So that was, but very, very rare. He was one of the only ones, and it's because I did a bunch of assignments. But that's a good episode. I just thought of it. I think I'll do an episode about
that. There you go. Look at that. We were there when it was happening. This is like watching Get Back. Paul McCartney is just like, I've got this idea for a song, guys.
But it's true, right? Like, if you think about it, when do you get feedback about your work? From someone that can actually, that besides the fact that it's either good or bad, I mean, contests, that's not really a good, honest critique or constructive criticism, because they're so biased in different ways. And online, it's just a mess of like people just commenting randomly. But someone giving you feedback on how to improve as a professional doesn't really happen. Maybe that's why we all stunt our growth in photography once we start shooting professionally.
I do. I think it is a real challenge, probably in a bunch of industries, because there's also an element of like, who are you and who's this person telling me this? And,
and, oh, we're an egotistical bunch, aren't we? And defensive.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine going to, you know, creative people, especially going to great people. There's a great quote I really liked. It was Noel Gallagher was talking about making records as part of Oasis in the 90s. And he was like, I would go into a recording studio in June in a fur coat and sunglasses, and we'd lay down this 9-minute version of a track, and they go, oh, that'll be really good when it's edited down. You go, what are you talking about? It's perfect. And he's like, I needed editors. I needed people to kind of say no. He's like, no one ever said no. And, you know, almost more damaging is nobody ever saying anything other than got it. And then you just, then you're just left. And then, and that's the kind of the thing early in your career, when there's people around you whose own success relies on yours. So you get a lot of support and kind of like, oh, more of this, less of this. But once you get competent enough to not mess up consistently, then you just get left on your own. And I think that happens in a lot of industries and a lot of like, but especially creative work, you do it a few times. Yeah. And you don't know why, you know, you don't know. Creative people often don't know why it works. They just know it works. And they've done a few things that work for them and speak to them and people like, but they can't tell you.
You go back to the well on every single assignment, you know, and that's what for me, like personal projects for me were like a way to be like, oh, okay, let me experiment. Let me try a little bit, but I still didn't have the feedback I wanted. Like I did hire that same editor later on, years later, to help me edit my project. And that was great feedback. And it was money well spent, because he seeing images that I wasn't looking at. He was helping me sequencing stories the way I wouldn't. Coming from it, from an editor standpoint, was important. So like, I know there's a ton of like portfolio reviews out there, but some people kind of half-ass it. But like, I think if you get the right one, it could be quite beneficial. And if you're honest, you have to like project that you're open to the feedback.
Yeah.
But like, I have, and I still don't get it. Even when I did a TV show, and I I have a face for radio, and I did a TV show. I was the face of the show. I was so naive, I didn't even realize I was the face of the show until a year into it. After the first season, they started promoting me with like on buses and stuff in Southeast Asia and buildings. I'm like, oh, like I'm the guy. I didn't even know. I'm just so like stupid with that stuff. I thought I was just like the main character of this photography reality show. But yeah, it was just I asked them. I'm like, I have no experience in television. I'm the best photographer here because it's like no one else is a photographer, but help me become better on TV. And they didn't. And I'm like, They're like, oh, you're fine. I'm like, yeah, but when is that? Like, I'm like, I want to be as good as this as I am as photography and keep improving. And like every season, no one helped me improve. I tried, I asked, and I worked on it myself, but it would have been nice to get people who 20 years of experience in television saying, hey, they're just like, no, you got it. We focus on helping other people. I'm like, yeah, but like I drive the show. Shouldn't you want to help me get better? And I'm telling you, I'm open to it. It's not like a trick. But yeah, it's an interesting part of photography I never thought of until I talked to you, Ian, that we don't really improve because there's no one. You just improve if you don't get work, I guess, because you're like, well, why isn't no one hiring me? Or if an editor says we weren't happy. But you always get buzzwords. Oh, where's the wow shot? And like, what does that mean? You want an explanation. And if it's a good creative director, yes, not many people are doing that. If it's a good editor, great, but they don't typically have the time to deal with that. If you didn't do a good job, they just don't hire you. If you did do a good job, they just hire you again. They don't care if you get better. I used to try, man. I fought the fight. I was like, hey, I'm also open to getting better on this. So if you have any thoughts, no one ever wants to do that. Never anyone. I'm like, okay, that's silly.
But it's the thing they've not allocated time for.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah,
it's weird. It's something I should be talking about more.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to the stuff you make about that. I think kind of leading off from that, like one thing, your last lens choice was a really interesting one to me because it feels like something you only discovered fairly recently, which is that 100mm R lens adapted. The R system feels like the black sheep of the Leica family. Like nobody really talks about it. And it seems like it was an incredible system with incredible glass that was really, really versatile at the time and really, really good. So how did you discover this 100? Were you in a mode of like trying new stuff and exploring things and sort of that feedback search or?
Yeah, so I'm not like a historian with Leica stuff. People, I just tap into other people that I meet. And when I talk about, like when I was at the SL3 launch thing, I was invited there. There was a bunch of other fellow Leica nerds there and they, I was just like, you know, I want a macro lens because like I have such weird use cases that don't apply to most people. So my use cases for a macro lens are one, just having one long lens in my SL kit or my editorial kit or wildlife kit for the occasional time I can't get close to an animal. So again, I'm finding stories that I can get close to animals on purpose and that people get close all in an ethical way. But occasionally a sloth climbs a tree and I can't climb with it. So I want that shot, right? Or occasionally I just want to like, I want a shot where I can condense everything. Or, you know, the rhinos are coming back from their day out in the pasture and I just want like a long shot. So it's very minimal use cases and editorial use, but still enough to have something with me that's not a giant lens, like a 90 to, what's the, like a SL90 to 280. Like that's a big commitment. So... And I also worked all my assignments for the New York Times for a while with a 35, and then I started to use a 35 and a 135. It was a weird combination, but it bailed me out of a couple things. So that's one use case. Another use case was also like, I just want macro shots for B-roll when I do I do bag reviews and some gear reviews. So it was like, I don't need autofocus because I can kind of manipulate it here in my little home studio. So I was like, oh, that would be good for those shots. And then more importantly, I'm like, I'm into portraits for my own personal work, but also like on assignment sometimes it's nice to get a portrait that's like here, a really tight shot of someone's eyes. And I'm like, the 50-1.4, you can focus pretty close, but not that close. Yeah. And I was like, that would open up some creative possibilities to me. So my existing kit before was the 35, the 50, and the 100, 135 F4, old school M lens. And I'm like, right. And I like it, but I'm like, oh, you know what would be better? I would use more because I'm doing less of the stories and more of the editorial stuff. Plus these travel stories I do with details. I've got to get like a food shot or coffee or, you know, details of someone's hands and making stuff. There's always like craftsmen in my story somehow. And so that's a lot of weird use cases, but I was like, that would be perfect, a macro lens. So I thought of the 100 Panasonic. Some people love that. Didn't really fit well with the other. It has autofocus on it. Again, didn't need that, but I wanted that same feel and manual feel. So I talked to Leica people. I was at like the classic store. I talked to some fellow Leica nerds, and they were like, you should consider the R100 or you consider the 60 R. And I'm like, okay. So they let me test out. They had two there, and it was a little bit of an impulse buy, but I've been researching a macro. So I'm like, all right, let me try this out. So I borrowed the both, and I ended up gravitating towards the 100 just because the 60 was too close to a 50. I think for a lot of people, if you didn't have a 50, the 60 is great. For me, it was like the 100 is going to be something a little different. I can use it for a telephoto in a pinch, and I can use it for macro video, and I can use it mainly for these detail shots and portrait shots. And I loved it. You know, I get to use like a car museum. I'm the only one with the SL3. It's like 100 YouTubers and photographers wandering around this car museum with the Leica SL3. And whatever like SL lens they gave us the option. Like, it's funny, everyone wanted the zoom lens. A few of us wanted the primes. And I took a prime. I took a 50 like SL lens, like the Summicron. It's not a super fancy lens, but I didn't use it at all. I just took the 100 with the adapter. I put it on and I used that and I had some fun with it. And when I got back to Vietnam, I'm like, wow, I love this. I used it for portraits. It made me see things differently, work differently. I'm not going to say like optically it's going to compare to whatever lens. I have some people say it. I had someone write like, oh, it's crap, or someone say, I don't know. Like, I'm not that type of person. I like that it's a macro. I like the way it feels. And it looked good enough to me. I always look at it like how I look at it. I'm not like zooming in. If I never zoom in, then I don't care what it looks like zoomed in. So I don't think it's optically crap, but I don't know if you put some sort of charts up and told me one other lens was better, I don't care. It just, to my eye, it looked good. I liked it. Yeah. And I like it. I'm not like super lazy where I don't care if it's obvious crap, but it's not. It was sharp. It looked good. And it was fine for me. I'm sure some charts will tell me there's another lens that's better, that's cheaper, but it works. I'm also factoring in the feel. It's a bit chunky. And that focus throw is like not having power steering in a car. So that's a bit much. But I don't mind. Again, it's slowing down. It doesn't matter to me. And the way I'm using it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. Like, again, the purpose of these conversations was not about graphs and a little red book that says this one's optically perfect in this way.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, because again, my favorite Zeiss. It's very the way that, you know, it's not sharp at the edges and it's got a very kind of like slightly antique feel almost to it, but it's tiny, and it means it can go in and out of a bag or it can sit under your jacket. And I can just walk around with it all day, and I can just, and I think if the result speaks for you and you enjoyed using it, like, that's the point, right? And also, that R100 in the world of Leica is not a horrendously priced lens. It's fairly accessible.
Yeah, that's a pretty good price. I think I got it for $950, which is great.
Yeah. So to get a decent one at that sort of cost and to be able to use it, it's like, all these things exist in the world. There's thousands of these lenses knocking around that people aren't using because, like, or if I'm not shooting whatever, it's not perfect. I love the Elmer 28. That's an incredible lens, and it's got a real lovely contrast to it. It's, you know, pin sharp, super tiny, and people look down their nose at it a little bit. It's like, it doesn't get the love it deserves, and it's an incredible lens. And you just think, but the pictures it makes of my kids outdoors, like toasting marshmallows, are wonderful. The sunlight on their hair and just everything. And it's like, it takes me back to that, to around a little fire pit, toasting marshmallows. And it's like, if the lens does that, like that portrait you posted the other day of the woman whose face is in shade from the hat, from that lens. Oh, just like, that's why we do it. It's to make stuff like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it gets me excited. Like, that was so funny, because using that lens was during my workshop, and I was like overdoing it, like shooting. Normally I'm watching and I'm like, here's how you do it, guys, and let me do a portrait here. And I'm like, I should probably be letting them do this right now, but I'm finding shots everywhere, and I got into like photographer mode, you know. So I had to like, my wife was like, all right, back to work, Justin. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm not on assignment here. But that's the fun feeling I want in a lens and a camera, and I have that, you know. And I had it for that lens, and I was like, that made me feel like, oh, it's definitely the right purchase. That shit needs to be sustainable. It's not like all lenses would give you that excitement for the first day, but I was using it for like the entire week, and I was loving it. Up in the northern mountains of Vietnam, we did a little story up there. And again, I found myself doing the same thing. My students were shooting. I had set up a nice little story for them that I could focus on. And then there's other people around. I'm like, oh, this would be a great portrait. Let me get this person over here and do some portraits of this woman with these seamstresses with headlamps. And I just had so much fun with it. And it was just like, I using it for the macro purposes, pulling back. And I just enjoyed it. Like it, if you know you can't focus that close to someone's eyes, you don't look at the details in their eyes. Once you do, then you realize like you start to look for different things. Same with details, and the same with like having a longer focal length. You start to see like, oh, that would work well compressed. So I like things that force me to think differently, because I don't always force myself to do it. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, I think it's good. I think that's why primes are good. A friend of mine was talking to me yesterday. She's just bought a new camera. She's coming back to photography, and she's got a zoom. And I was saying to her, you know, if you can get the cheapest 35 prime you can, because she's going traveling.
Yeah.
And I was like, it'll make it feel a bit smaller, and also it'll remove options. Just shove it on the front and just learn one lens and one thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 35 isn't right. Maybe you're a 50 person or whatever, but try and find that one that you really like, because the limitation is freeing, and it will, you'll just run around and capture things, and it will help remove that kind of any pressure of, you know, like, well, now I should be using this for this, and now I should be using that for that. You'll make much more, because creativity is all about, I think, the iteration loop. How many iteration loops can you go through? Because that's when you learn, is when you do the whole cycle. And the great thing about photography, especially digital photography, is that loop can be really short. So you can go out one day, make some images, look at them, and just in the back of your mind be like, right, okay, I learned something from that. And then tomorrow you can apply what you learned. Or, you know, it can be quite short.
That's why I like to teach projects to people that do the same thing. So like I'm such a big fan of, a big advocate of telling people like, let's get a project where this person does the same thing. Like, isn't that going to be boring? I'm like, no, because you're going to take I'm going to take my Justin shots the first day. And then on the second day, I'm going to shed some of those. Then the third day, I'm going to get elevated versions of my first one. Then the fourth day, I'm going to try new things, you know, or whatever that. You want to shorten that period. But that's just what happens. Like every time I go into a story, get what works. You come to Vietnam, people like, they in my workshops, I'm like, I don't want you to take beautiful pictures of my workshop. I want you to fail miserably. I want you to take some shots that are crap, so that after my workshop, you try new things. Like, don't come here with your toolkit of like what you think's a good shot, and then just dump that
just
on Vietnam
that
and use Vietnam. Use yourself. Like people, I always find that funny when I critique people's work too. It's like they always think their best works. I have them go through this exercise where they share their 10 best photos to me, but they also I also have them share their website, and sometimes they do like long-term mentorships with me. So I get to see more of their work. I'm like, you're a terrible editor of your own work. You have these great shots from your hometown and small town, Rhode Island or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you went to India once and you just think, cause everyone looks different, your photos are good. Like they're just the same photos. Just the people look different in the background.
Yeah.
Like, it's not better composition. It's not better light. And your photos back at home were much better because you were more comfortable. You were more patient and you didn't just like, just stop and shoot. You actually constructed nice pictures and told the story. So it's typically when people travel, people would argue with me like, yeah, but don't you live in Vietnam and all your best stuff? But I'm like, yeah, but I live here. That's my best stuff. And I'm comfortable here. And that's why I get my best shots here. Because, so, I mean, I think people are very guilty of letting the country or the unique experience do the work for them. And I try to really not, it's not that satisfying to some at first, but I get messages afterwards where they're like, oh, that was great. Like I went to this project afterwards. I'm like, good. That's what you should do. I don't want a workshop where I teach you how to take my photographs. What does that help you do? You know what I mean? Great. Go and take your own, learn who you are. And projects are a great way to do that. It's a great way to figure out who you are and slow down. And then you do it with someone you're comfortable with. So then you're comfortable and then you can really be yourself. And then when you're ready to do a story with a stranger, you've built this foundation that you can go apply it to that story. And you're a lot more comfortable and that'll shine through in your images.
Yeah, I think that's a good kind of note to end on in terms of like a workshop is you're not there to impress the person running the workshop. They're there to help you get better. And if you mess up or you don't get stuff you like, that's more probably more useful than going in and leaving with a body of work that is great.
Yeah, I feel so. That's the way I like to teach. I mean, I can have take someone's camera and take pictures for them if they want, but what does that do? Here you go.
I'll just hand you my camera and I can pretend these are mine.
How does that help you? You know, I can see why people do it the other way because you want to make people happy there short term. But I like to think that people come to my workshops so that for not that experience so that they come and they can learn. And we'll take some nice pictures, but I want them to really grow during and more afterwards. I did. For me, I did a workshop with Gary Knight a long time ago, a famous conflict photographer. My pictures were crap in that workshop. They were terrible. And he said it to me. He was honest with me. And I was a terrible photographer leading up to that. And I'll always say this story, and I'll be quick, but there was 10 of us in that workshop. Some wanted to be pros, some didn't. But I think now, 20 years later, I'm the only one who's a professional photographer. So I was the worst, but I'm the only one that did it because I stayed with it. And I worked on it. I got better because of what I learned during it, I applied to afterwards.
Yeah. No, that consistency and that determination, I think, is a big part of it. Iteration cycles for me. Yeah, I see it in creative work all the time.
You just worded it in a way cooler way than I do. I like that. I'm going to steal that from you.
Please do. Please do. I said something on a recent call. I said something about teams reflect their leads. And Ben was just like, you've had that ready to go. And I was like, yeah, I know. I say it a lot. I just, my work managing teams and stuff bleeds through into this. You know, in my day job, I'm a sort of a closeted creative to some extent. I work with creative people and I sort of get creative work, but my job is like email and talking to people. So yeah. This is what's such a treat about conversations like this with people who make for a living, is to kind of like connect with that and connect with the act of making by the kind of slightly shameless route of a gear conversation, you know?
Yeah, no, it's just, I feel like we balanced it well, Ian. I feel like we balanced it here. That's the exact balance I'd like in life. So anytime you want to talk about photography, we've got a good balance. We've got a good flow.
Oh, love it. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really, really appreciate it. I think I've not been so happy about getting up at 4 a.m. for a long time.
I didn't realize you'd get up so early. I'm sorry. An hour later. I'm sorry.
It's better because everyone's asleep. So it's actually quiet. I'm guaranteed quiet time because in about an hour, the kids will get up and then it will be breakfast and then it'll be getting ready for school. So this is actually, I was talking to my wife about it. It's like, as mental as it is, it's actually a perfect time to record.
Okay, that's good. All right, don't hate me for it then. All right.
No. I'm going to go back to bed for an hour. It'll all be good.
Enjoy your rest. It was very nice to meet you here, kind of in person, and great to talk to Tom. I look forward to seeing it when it's out there and helping you promote it.
Oh, thank you, man. No, I really appreciate it. It's been a wonderful conversation. I am certain to bother you again in future, I'm sure.
Anytime. I hope we connect. Come to Vietnam.
Yes, I will. All right, mate. Well, have a lovely rest of day. Take care.
Same to you. Get some rest.
My thanks to Justin for joining me for that. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. You can rate and review this series on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and that'll help people to find the show. I can't really believe we've done 6 episodes already. It's crazy. You can also sign up for a midweek newsletter that I've started doing. It's just a little something midweek to remind you of prime lenses, and hopefully it's fun. You can get that at ianfarrell.com/sign-up, and there is a link to it in the show notes as well. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.